Welcome to Oncology Today, the potential role of PROTAC ER degraders in the treatment of hormone receptor positive breast cancer. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Erica Hamilton from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Tennessee, to discuss the emerging therapeutics of proteolysis-targeting chimera molecules, otherwise known as PROTACs. To begin, Dr. Hamilton provided her vision of the pathophysiology and pharmacology of ER-positive breast cancer.
So essentially, you know, estrogen receptor-positive breast cancers are just cancer cells that when estrogen binds, it feeds and grows and the tumor proliferates, right? So I always tell patients there's nothing wrong with your estrogen levels. It's not too high. It's not too low. It's just your cancer likes estrogen. And if there's estrogen around, it gets more food. It grows more, right? So the way aromatase inhibitors work is after menopause, our ovaries don't make estrogen anymore. And so the only way your body has estrogen is conversion of normal body steroids and testosterone, the male hormone, into estrogen through the enzyme called aromatase. So if we use an aromatase inhibitor and those steroids can't be converted into estrogen and they're not making any estrogen in their ovaries, their estrogen goes to zero. And so you shouldn't be able to bind estrogen on the estrogen receptor. The problem is these cancer cells can get mutations, ESR1 mutations. And I describe that to my patients as it doesn't need estrogen anymore to turn the light switch on. That switch got turned on in the absence of estrogen and it had a conformational change, right? So where SERMs and SERDs come in is SERMs actually bind the estrogen receptor on the cancer cell, but it causes a different conformational change and it can actually be different from tissue to tissue. So that's why with SERMs like tamoxifen, you have some tissues like the uterus where it's agonistic, it encourages estrogen growth, and other tissues like the breast where it's antagonistic based on what conformational change happens when that SERM binds the estrogen receptor in the tissue. And then SERDs, again, also a molecule that binds the estrogen receptor. But what it does, interestingly, is causes a conformational change that marks it as foreign. So the body can chew it up and spit it out. So they all work on the estrogen receptor, either by preventing estrogen from being able to bind, causing a conformational change, or essentially chewing it up and spitting it out.
And just to clarify, too, I guess there are now agents, I guess elacestrin's one, that is maybe considered a SERD and a SERM as both properties. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. So it's actually a continuum, right? I don't know. It's kind of like black and white. No color is actually black. No color is actually white. You know, your white paint in your house actually has some red and some blue and some yellow in it. So, you know, elacestrin is the most SERM-like of all the SERDs, meaning that it can actually have some agonistic activity instead of just strictly degradation activity. And so that's actually kind of why I'm excited to see some of the other SERD data. You know, we've seen randomized data with camizestrin that looked pretty good, but elacestrin's our only FDA-approved drug. And it's actually not a SERD, it's a SERM. So I think we may actually see differential activity in different populations, et cetera, for these drugs that are kind of true SERDs.
So let's focus in a little bit more on SERDs, and then we'll get into some of the new, particularly the PROTACs, that's so interesting. But can you talk a little bit more about what we know about SERDs? You talked a little bit about how they work, but also the clinical pharmacology, and maybe we can get into a little bit some of the data as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back a bit. We have a SERD, it's fulvestrant, and it's administered intramuscularly. When we were developing this drug, we messed up on the dose. We thought it was 250, and it turned out it was 500. And so by the time we really figured this out, it was almost out of patent life. And I think a lot of us think, had we had gotten fulvestrant's dose right earlier with more patent life, that there probably would have been a large adjuvant trial, and maybe we would have been using adjuvant fulvestrant instead of aromatase inhibitors. So first off, SERD is not a new concept. What's new is that there are oral SERDs. They're more potent. It doesn't have the liability of needing two shots intramuscularly and not kind of getting degradation to that degree. It should be active in both wild type as well as ESR1 mutations. But as we know, we're seeing a little bit better activity in tumors that have ESR1 mutations, really because that's a poor man's surrogate of how likely is this cancer to still be dependent on the estrogen axis. There's nothing magic about an ESR1 mutation. We just don't have a better assay to ask the question of, does this cancer still care about ER? And then we know that post-CDK4/6 has been a big area of unmet need. Fulvestrant, for example, used to give us a PFS of about 6 months. And now in the post-CDK setting, we're getting a PFS of about 1.8 months. And so it looks like the SERDs being more potent, bioavailable, easier to get to the dose we need to, really more effective molecules, have better activity than fulvestrant.
Wow, you said something that I was not aware of. It makes a lot of sense because, you know, I kept hearing more recently, you know, fulvestrant having PFS of 2 months. I'm like, I thought fulvestrant was a pretty good drug. So what you're saying is actually fulvestrant is less effective in people who have prior CDK?
100%. We've had two randomized trials now that looked at fulvestrant in a control arm, and everyone had to have had prior CDK4/6. Emerald is a good example, right? The trial that elacestrant was approved off of, the vast majority of people in the control arm got fulvestrant. But when we look at that just in the fulvestrant, it was 1.8 months. The other randomized trial was actually the randomized trial looking at venetoclax. It was a negative trial, fulvestrant alone, fulvestrant venetoclax, but PFS was less than 2 months.
But, you know, forgive me for not remembering, but like, what was the PFS before CDK?
5 to 6 months across study. Huh. So, I mean, triple as long.
What about response rate? Because I used to hear about fulvestrant responses.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll say that ER positive breast cancer is typically the area in breast cancer that we don't talk much about response rate, right? Our more highly proliferative cancers, triple negative and HER2, are the ones where we're more likely to see PCRs in the neoadjuvant setting. It's the one that we're more likely to see tumors having an objective response rate. ER positive, because it's kind of slower growing, doesn't have that high Ki-67 typically. We typically don't see great response rates. All the oral SERDs have an overall response rate of like 2 to 15%. I mean, it's all pretty much less than 10%. What we really care about is stable disease, PFS, and duration of benefit. Success there is cancer not growing, no new spots.
But I mean, just to clarify, what do you think is the response rate of first-line therapy with ER-positive disease to an AI and CDK?
Now, there we have a response rate with CDK. After first-line, the response rate of fulvestrant, et cetera, less than 10%.
I was just bringing it up because you're kind of like trashing ER positive response rate. You do see it in the first line. It's just once they get past that. And it kind of ties into also the data that came out, particularly from the Emerald trial, that I didn't exactly pick up on and right away. It kind of took a while, at least for me. I don't know about the investigators related to this issue of endocrine sensitivity, how long they've been on CDK, and what happens in the first, you know, 6 months or year in these patients.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And so if you look at these curves, essentially about 50% of patients were progressing at their first scan, regardless of what arm they were on. And so those are patients that, you know, if we had the magic ball, we would probably say, that cancer isn't endocrine sensitive anymore. That's somebody that needs to move on to ADCs, chemo, et cetera, right? But we don't have that. And so what we saw was it was a positive trial, but the benefit was 1 month in terms of PFS. If we enriched for patients that had ESR1 mutations, again, those that, you know, were so dependent on the estrogen axis that they ended up with this mutation that made them be able to signal through it even when estrogen wasn't around, we about double that, about a 2 month PFS benefit. But if we enrich for duration of prior CDK4/6, then we get up into like the 8 month benefit. So again, we're using all of these surrogates of endocrine sensitivity because we don't have an assay. They're still ER positive if we stain their tissue, using ESR1, using duration to the last endocrine therapy to really enrich for a population that we feel pretty confident are most likely to have endocrine sensitivity in their tumors.
I don't know. I got to tell you, weird things fly into my mind. We just did a webinar the other day, believe it or not, on desmoid tumors.
Oh,
they've got this. They have this nirogacestat as a new drug, and yeah. But the thing that was really cool about it is they went back and looked at the phase three trial, and they looked at patients who had stable disease. Now, this is different. I wish they had done this, and I'm going to ask you about in breast cancer. And they actually showed improved patient-reported outcomes in the people who had radiologically stable disease. Mm-hmm. So they had, they demonstrated clear-cut quality of life improvement, even though the tumors, you know, weren't shrinking, which I had never seen. And when I see stuff like you go from 2 to 5 months of PFS and you don't have a response rate to look at, it kind of makes me wonder, like, what's the granularity of the benefit? And I mean, do you see people that you look at them go, you know, they definitely feel better, they're, you know, their bone pain's better, or, you know, is it maybe not as effective as
I do? And that's why, you know, I tell companies that are developing drugs, don't hang your hat on response rate in ER positive breast cancer. It really isn't your best measure. It's PFS, it's clinical benefits rate, it's how the patient is doing. You know, the one additional thing to add is that ER positive is our cancer that's most likely to have bone only disease. And so those patients are non-measurable by definition, right? And so in bone lesions, we don't see them go away. We see them become sclerotic and maybe not take up much activity on a PET or a bone scan. But so you can imagine if that bone lesion isn't active anymore, that patient's pain gets better. But radiologically, you aren't going to call them a CR because they weren't measurable. And so, you know, it's just not the best measure of somebody with ER-positive disease to talk about a response rate.
Right. Yeah, that's such a great point. And I guess the other thing is you're mentioning the fact that elacestrant, you know, is actually kind of a SERM. What about, you know, you have camizestrant, you have imlunestrant, there are a bunch of other SERDs. Are they more pure SERDs and anything in their data? You know, you showed some data on camizestrant that, you know, indirectly looks like maybe it's better or not really?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that elacestrant is the SERD that's different in the fact that it's a SERM. The other SERDs do tend to be more uniform in terms of their degradation activity. You know, they truly are a selective estrogen receptor degrader. What I don't think that they're all equal for is in side effect profile. And we should know this by what's quoted. You know, I personally think there are some that are a little bit more tough in terms of GI toxicity than others, but that's really hard to tease out in phase one posters, you know, with reported rates, because a lot of people in a phase one trial have a little bit of nausea, have diarrhea. That just happens. We know that a couple can cause bradycardia. We know that one causes phytopsia. So, I mean, we know that these drugs are different because they're causing a little bit of a different side effect. But, you know, I think that this class can really be encouraging.
Incidentally, I'm all excited. We submitted three abstracts to San Antonio. We got three posters out of it. So
that's fantastic.
I'm all excited. Yeah, yeah. No, that's great.
That means I'll see you in San Antonio.
Yeah, you're definitely seeing me in San Antonio for sure. But yeah, and actually one of them is about what we're talking about today. So as we go through this, I'm going to maybe tell you a little bit about what we are going to talk about there. But let's get into the main top thing I wanted to ask you about, PROTAC. I don't even necessarily understand the proteolysis targeting and chimera. You can start with those words and start working into particularly why it's different than a SERD.
Yeah. So it is different because a SERD is the molecule that binds to the estrogen receptor, causes that conformational change, chews it up, spits it out, right? So a PROTAC, or proteolysis targeting chimera, is a little molecule that binds to the estrogen receptor. But what it does is recruits an E3 ligase, this big monster that comes in. It binds it and then brings the estrogen receptor and the E3 ligase in close proximity. So the E3 ligase ubiquinates the estrogen receptor. When it gets ubiquinated, that's essentially a flag of this is a foreign invader, chomps it up, spits it out, and then the PROTAC molecule's free to go to the next estrogen receptor and do this all over again. So it's a different, newer twist on how it degrades, if that makes sense.
It does, but also I think about proteasome degradation, you know, when bortezomib and myeloma, is that tied into this big thing you're talking about or totally different?
You know, I like to joke, Neil, that you're probably the one oncologist in America that could get a perfect score on boards. I don't know much about myeloma, so you're going to have to tell me.
Well, I'll have to ask them, but I know that they obviously they have proteasome. It's been a big part of it, but just trying to understand what goes on in terms of the, and also selinexor is another one. But I know you've done work on selinexor, so I don't know whether that, again, I guess a different mechanism than selinexor too?
Different mechanism, very different side effect profile.
Yeah, for sure, that's for sure. So let's talk a little bit more about PROTAX. And one thing I'm starting to hear, you know, of course I've been hearing about it in prostate cancer. And the other day I started hearing about it with lymphoma, BTK PROTAX. Mm-hmm. Know anything about either one of those things? What's going on in prostate or lymphoma with so-called PROTAX?
I do know a little bit about prostate because the same company that had the first PROTAC also had the androgen receptor PROTAC degrader. And so we worked with both of those in the phase one unit. So very similar idea. Instead of, targeting the estrogen receptor, it's targeting the androgen receptor. Big play in prostate cancer.
So anything more you want to say about what this actually is? But can you talk a little bit about what a chimera is?
Yeah, it's just essentially a flexible molecule that's going to bind, one side on the estrogen receptor, which is the green blob, and the other side on the E3 ligase. And so when those come in together, that's how essentially it gets ubiquinated and the proteasome comes in and chews it up and spits it out. So really just a flexible molecule, and its whole role is to bring your target, the estrogen receptor, in very close proximity to the E3 ligase so that can happen.
Okay. So can you talk about what agents we know?
Vepdegestrant.
That's the agent that's farthest along. I know you've presented on that. I'm really curious what your experience has been with it. But what about these other agents I see in breast? You have AC699, doesn't have a name yet. And there you go, BTK and prostate. What about AC699? That's not quite as far along.
It's in phase one. We've been using it for quite some time. We had presented a little bit of data at ESMO regarding that. Just to make it a little bit more complicated with all these naming conventions, it's really a PROTAC, but the PROTAC name is trademarked. And so they, they're a degrader in the same way, but they're just not using the PROTAC name because they can't.
That's interesting. Yeah, I heard that. That is really interesting. Sort of, it's the same thing, but you can't use the word. What about what has been seen? I know there's this phase one escalation study. You had a few responses. I know that's not the main thing you're looking for at this stage, but what did you see?
Yeah, what stands out to me about the phase one experience is, everyone had seen CDK4/6. And so that's really the tricky thing when comparing different phase ones in SERDs is you're comparing apples to oranges because some had seen CDK, some, three quarters of people had seen CDK, some only half had seen CDK. And we know PFS, et cetera, is really going to vary by whether people had seen CDK. So everyone had seen CDK, over 80% of people had seen fulvestrant, over half of people had seen chemo. So this is a very kind of heavily pretreated real world scenario. And what we saw is we never reached an MTD. We had no dose limiting toxicities. And so these things are kind of telling me, this drug seems pretty well tolerated, right? No grade 4 treatment related adverse events. Most were grade 1 or grade 2. And we saw that the clinical benefit rate, so either a confirmed, a complete response, a partial response, or stable disease of at least 6 months. And so, not just a scan, but that they were progression-free for at least 6 months, which is our old fulvestrant benchmark, was 40%. And we did see a couple responses as well. And then, what was very interesting from this, and the most of them were my patients, but there were a small number of patients that had actually already seen an investigational oral SERD. And it seemed like even those patients responded at kind of the same frequency that those who hadn't seen it. And so this was kind of a really exciting thing when I thought about, could we sequence these agents? So I think that was pretty exciting.
I'm still kind of thinking a little bit about what you were saying about post-CDK fulvestrant, activity. I was also flashing, I did a program the other day with Seth Wander, and he was talking about this paper looking at mechanisms of resistance to CDK, and my head almost exploded. It was just like too much to even think about. But globally, can you simplify it a little bit? Like when you give CDK, now you're treating in the post CDK, you know, sort of setting. How does that fundamentally change, you know, how these agents work?
Well, part of the challenge, and I bet that was an intricate conversation. You can definitely go into a lot of details with Seth on that. You know, fundamentally, the problem is there isn't just a mechanism of resistance that we know about. You know, when CDKs first came out and we were thinking that we were going to see this mechanism of resistance, we all thought it was RB. I mean, I think almost everybody agreed on that. And then lo and behold, when we looked at the mutational profiles post-CDK, there were some RBs. There were some PI3s. There was a slew of things, and it was very variable. And so, you know, that's one of the biggest unmet needs right now in ER-positive breast cancer is that we don't have a good endocrine sensitivity assay, a test we can send to say, is this cancer still signaling through the estrogen axis, or is it still ER-positive on IHC, but it's fooling us, and it's not going to respond to endocrine therapy. We need to move to ADCs, and we just don't have that right now.
What about the data looking at these agents combined with CDK? You know, I've seen that with SERDs too, and I'm trying to figure out, like, where is this all heading? Is there going to be a phase three trial, comparing, you know, CDK plus these new things?
Yeah, that is where it's heading. There are going to be phase threes. And, you know, you can imagine that there's essentially about three places that these drugs can end up. You can end up in second line after our current standard, which is first line AI and CDK4/6. And now we have more data from Dr. Kalinske and others that maybe CDK beyond CDK progression is worthwhile. So having some data in combination with CDK is helpful there. You can imagine these drugs beating out AI and going first line with CDK. Maybe that's the most dangerous spot because we have a little bit of evidence from Falcon, et cetera, that maybe the backbone endocrine agent matters a little bit less when CDK is around. And then another actually very clean area is in the adjuvant setting where endocrine resistance really shouldn't be a problem. And so kind of replacing either the combo of high risk, you know, SERD with the CDK, or maybe after you finish your CDK, doing a switch strategy like we used to do tamoxifen to AI. And there are a lot of trials right now enrolling those patients.
Yeah, but, you know, I was thinking about how much data you would need before you'd be comfortable randomizing a patient between getting an AI and, you know, a SERD or a PROTAC, either first line and even more so in the adjuvant setting. I'd be pretty nervous about that unless I'd really encouraging data. What about these data? How encouraging are they?
Well, I'll tell you that we're doing it and I have no qualms about it. You know, we haven't had any, SERD or PROTAC data really that has shown us that they're inferior. There's been some that haven't shown us that they were statistically superior, but no data that it's inferior. And so we really think that it's probably going to help in mechanisms of resistance. So we did look at vepdegestrant with palbociclib. You can see, you know, the most common side effect is neutropenia. We shouldn't be surprised about this. You know, grade 3, 4, neutropenia happens in about 70% of the real world. In this type of population in phase one, already heavily pretreated, it's more common. What I was really excited to see, and this is the first data I've seen, where the PFS was the same whether you had an ESR1 mutation or whether you were ESR1 wild type. Out of all the other things we've seen, we always could enrich for a longer PFS, or said differently, if you didn't have an ESR1 mutation, your benefit was always less. And we didn't see that with vepdegestrant palbociclib. The PFS was 11 months in both the ESR1 mutations or those that had ESR1 wild type.
I guess sounds like it'd be better tolerated than an AI.
Yeah, and you know, I'll be quite honest. I have a little bit of equipoise there. I think in the metastatic setting, I feel pretty comfortable it's better tolerated. But we also know that in the metastatic setting, people don't really discontinue AIs infrequently. In the adjuvant setting, a lot of our patients discontinue AIs. And so when you put a drug in a patient that potentially is already cured, the risk benefit in their mind is different and how they experience the side effects are different compared to if they have cancer-related bone pain or all of these. And so it is going to be very interesting to see, is it as clean in the adjuvant setting as we think it is, because it looks really clean in the metastatic setting.
I mean, you could end up getting better efficacy just based on better, you know, adherence. Getting more drug in.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, you see, look at the old tamoxifen studies. I forget like exactly what fraction were non-adherent, but it was pretty substantial. And I know that there are trials looking at people who don't tolerate AIs and then switching them to some of these new agents. Anything you want to say about how they approach establishing the dose of epdegestrant? Yeah.
I think it's a similar story. You know, when we talked about camizestrant, you know, in the randomized trial, we had two different doses, 75 milligrams and 150 milligrams, partially because we just really needed to generate some robust data. It's not a chemotherapy drug where you're going to be able to define the MTD and say, this is where we need to go. And so it's pretty similar in the VERITAC study of epdegestrant. They looked at two doses, 200 milligrams and 500 milligrams. And lo and behold, 200 looked just as good at 500, just like camizestrant 75 looked just as good as 150. And so we're moving forward with the 200 milligram dose.
And is this a trial that's ongoing right now, the VERITAC 2 trial?
Yes, very clean, straightforward design of patients that have already had CDK4/6 in combination with endocrine therapy, up to one additional endocrine therapy, vepdegestrant versus fulvestrant.
So I don't know when you think maybe we might be seeing data from this, but whenever that is, which I assume won't be too long, I'm just trying to figure out how you're going to interpret it. You're going to have to, I guess, indirectly compare it to SERDs?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, right? You know, I think so far we only have one SERD approved, elacestrant, and it's only approved for patients that have ESR1 mutations. So we'll have to see if this has activity for wild type and ESR1 mutation, that really could be a game changer. You know, sending blood for mutation detection isn't cheap either.
What about the efficacy in patients with PIK3 mutations? Has that been looked at?
Yeah, it has been looked at. It doesn't really look like it's a variable. Whether patients have a PI3 or not, it looks like there's still benefit. I think the tougher question is, well, what are you going to pick next? You know, do you think the novel endocrine backbone is more important? Or how confident are you that this tumor is really driven off of PI3? You know, sometimes it's the driver, sometimes it's kind of a passenger mutation. So do you want to offer the PI3 in the next line?
And that also brings up a question. This actually was one of the things we had in one of our submissions to San Antonio, which is, what do people do when you have both PIK3 and ESR1 right now outside a clinical trial?
Yeah, I'll tell you, you're not going to get a single answer to that. Different people are going to give you different answers.
Well, that's what's in our poster, and I'm going to tell you the results. I think you're in our poster. You're one of the people in the poster because we had both investigators as well as not just average oncologists, but elite oncologists who presented cases at our meetings, et cetera. And we asked them what they do in a lot of situations, including this one. And actually, I was telling Seth that what we found was that it was 50-50, not just in the investigators, but also in the community docs. They're all like, I guess it depends on the presentation.
Well, and that's the thing. I think, you know, that you have different things you're thinking about. You know, maybe, well, I'm really following a mutation in terms of PI3. PI3 can be a driver. You're saying, maybe PFS is a little bit longer there than it is with elacestrant. But then you're saying, gosh, it is really tough to tolerate for a lot of patients, whether we're talking about hyperglycemia, rash, or diarrhea. Then you have elacestrant where you're saying, okay, maybe it's not going to work for as long in general, but it doesn't cause very many side effects. And so would my patient prefer the less toxic treatment first? So it's really, you know, I think we have equipoise about that. And honestly, I discuss it with the patient in front of me because different people have different feelings about it.
Just could get even more complicated. We start seeing new classes of drugs in the same space that might have to be considered. And here's the VERITAC 3 study that you were talking about, the first line trial combined with Palbo. Anything else you want to say about that study? And also, any thoughts? I think it's the Serena 6 study that's going to look at bringing in a SERD in someone who develops ESR1 mutations but has no clinical evidence of progression. So any thoughts about these trials, this and other trials in the first line setting? What do you like?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. It's not just vepdegestrant. So, you know, obviously this one's combining vepdegestrant with palbociclib, but you're right. There's a few versions of the Serena. Serena 4 is the kind of upfront similar trial like this. Serena 6 is testing for ESR1 mutations every couple of months. And if somebody pops positive for that, you either stay what you're on until radiographic progression, or you switch over to the camizestrant, essentially asking the question of, you know, can we delay progression there? There's other companies doing that with SERDs as well. It's not just, you know, these two. But, you know, I really like the idea, if we know that these compounds are better than our standard endocrine therapy, and we know that when we treat already, we end up with a lot of endocrine resistance, it really does beg the question of, let's bring it up earlier when we don't have the endocrine resistance, when people are more able to actually get the benefit and see what we see.
In a way, it kind of reminds me of some of the cell-free DNA trials, like in colon mm-hmm. cancer, where they look at that and they use that as a way to try to decide what to do. You know, another thing I kind of wondered about, is there any kind of, you know, everybody always asks this, any kind of immune issue that's overlaying this whole thing? I've heard people talk about CDK, for example, as maybe having an immune effect. Do you think that there's any immune aspect to any of this stuff?
I don't think so. Not in a whole lot of what I've seen, you know, particularly among low ER breast cancers, those less than 10%, you know, we have a lot of evidence now that those are really functionally negative tumors. We now have two trials showing benefit for immunotherapy in those patients, but not in this area. We're really talking about strongly ER-driven tumors.
So we were talking about AC-699, which is, quote, not a PROTAC, but really is. But anything you want to say about how it works?
Yeah. Can you tell it's kind of the same diagram, but drawn a different way? So exactly the same thing. You're binding, you're bringing in the E3 ligase, you're ubiquinating, you're chomping it up and spitting it out.
Any reason to think it's more effective or has deeper ER degradation? And for example, other PROTACs?
Yeah, maybe so. You know, I really think of it as in that PROTAC bucket, you know, ARV-471 and AC-699. You know, there are some preclinical models that look like they're a little more potent than SERDs. And, you know, with ARV-471, we discussed that, you know, other presentation with palbociclib really showing that the benefit was equal for ESR1 mutation or not. So I get this feeling that really needs to be proven in a clinical trial, but this feeling that these class of drugs may be better for patients that have a little bit of endocrine resistance, you know, maybe they're able to kind of get more people into that endocrine sensitive bucket than a true SERD can.
Yeah, that was one thing I have heard in the, you know, PIK3 ESR1 patients that, quote, people who are more endocrine resistant, it sounds like people think more about, you know, PIK3. Mm-hmm. More targeted, you know, I don't know about that. What about, you haven't said anything about neoadjuvant. How about neoadjuvant PROTACs? What are we going to see there?
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest. So far, the strategy for neoadjuvant for SERDs and PROTACs has been more about making sure the dose is right. Because we're not going to get an MTD. And so, you know, having the ability to give it for, you know, a certain amount of time, see responses, see if that's different, or even in a window trial, give it for a shorter amount of time, biopsy and see your estrogen receptor knockdown, et cetera. It's really been a little bit more about confirming dose before they spend a lot of money taking it to a randomized phase 3 and potentially making a mistake like we did with fulvestrant.
So anything you want to say about other applications of PROTACs? I have no idea what a ClipTac is or a photo PROTAC or antibody PROTAC conjugate. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'll tell you that my program manager put this slide together, and this slide blows my mind, the different applications that you can think about for PROTACs. And I think this goes back to what you were saying at the beginning of when we were talking about how many different ways already we can see it in 3 diseases that a PROTAC can be used. So a ClipTac, again, kind of that whole idea of bringing things in close proximity. They click intracellularly, enabling transfer through cellular membranes. Photo PROTACs blow my mind. So essentially a trifunctional molecule. You have the ligand for the E3 ligase. You have the ligand for whatever you're interested in, estrogen receptor, androgen receptor, and then a photo switch. So you have the ability to turn the molecule on and off based on whether it's in the presence of light. You could imagine that you could use this intraoperatively or maybe with some kind of modes of radiation where you have the ability to control when it's working or when it's not. I think that's super fascinating. And then you could use PROTACs kind of like instead of ADCs, APCs, so antibody PROTAC conjugates, where you could deliver a PROTAC selectively to the cells that express the antigen. So a lot of opportunity to be very precise here.
So you've got a couple of cases to talk about. These are actual patients in your practice?
Yeah, they are.
So let's hear about this 37-year-old woman.
Yeah. So this lady was actually diagnosed with de novo metastatic disease, unfortunately. She presented with a mass in her armpit, which is how she found this, and also bone pain. It was ERPR positive on biopsy. It was HER2 FISH non-amplified, 1+ by IHC. And she got what was pretty standard in the first line setting at that point, ovarian function suppression because she was premenopausal and young. Letrozole, an AI, and ribociclib, a CDK4/6 inhibitor, in combination with a bone agent because of her bone mets. As expected, she did very well on this for 34 months, so just shy of 3 years, which is not uncharacteristic for what we see in clinic. She did have to have a dose reduction on the ribociclib, really for a combination of kind of low neutrophil count, so we kept having to delay things a little bit, and fatigue. Ultimately, she had progression with 2 new liver mets, some additional bone lesions as well. And she actually went on the clinical trial with ARV-471 with me. She had a 33% PR as measured by the shrinkage in her liver lesions. And she's been on drug for 18 months and still continuing.
What's her biomarker status?
She does not have an ESR1 mutation.
And no PIK3 either?
No.
Interesting. Any quality of life issues when treatment now?
No, she has a little bit of hot flashes, things like that. You know, she was also premenopausal. And so I think a lot of that came from the fact that we, you know, are using ovarian function suppression and thrust her into menopause, but, you know, doesn't take any antiemetics, doesn't have diarrhea, does have some fatigue. And it's always a little bit of hard to tease out what's coming from the cancer and what's coming from the drug.
And a couple other things about her case, I'm curious, just a sort of background in terms of endocrine therapy. One is, like a lot of patients, she got started on ribo. And I'm just kind of curious what you see as first-line CDK use, not just in your own practice, but I'm particularly interested in the general community oncology practice, particularly in older patients. I know, you know, younger people like this, people latch onto the survival benefit. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, about your choice of CDK. I see a lot of docs in practice using palbo, particularly in older people. And I'm just curious whether you bring that up to patients.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. You know, I used palbo at the beginning, too. I mean, that was pretty much my, you know, universal CDK that I wrote for. You know, the reality is we have 3 drugs. We have clinical trials. One in particular didn't show a overall survival benefit, despite the fact that PFS looked very similar. So for me, when I'm having that conversation with a patient, it's hard for me to argue unless, you know, there's a QTC issue or something like that of, you know, trying to argue in favor of palbo. Well, you know, it didn't show this, but I just really think it's wrong. And I think palbo is so much better because of the other two, because of something like, I just can't really do that. And so I have switched my practice to ribociclib. You know, market share data, as you say, shows that a lot of people are still getting palbociclib, you know, particularly in community centers where access to EKGs may require a cardiology consult. Maybe you don't, you know, you're not in a clinical trial center. You're not running EKGs on patients all the time anyway. You know, that can be a burden. You have to check LFTs. You know, so there are some differences with ribo. Abema, I think, you know, the thing that's more the burden is just from the patient standpoint of having to take meds for diarrhea. But I have switched my practice to ribociclib almost universally.
I'm just kind of curious. I guess one question would be, is quality of life better on palbo? There are docs in the community who use palbo, particularly in older people, because they think it's better tolerated. Do you agree with that?
I think that ribo and palbo are better tolerated than abema. You know, neutropenia rates, fatigue rates, all of that is very similar. You know, is the fact that I have to do two EKGs at start and at cycle one, day 15, going to affect somebody's quality of life? I don't think so. I mean, that's not something that they experience at home. I'm the one checking the LFTs. They don't feel that. So I don't think they experience that. I mean, I think the patient's experience of palbo and ribo are very similar.
That's interesting. One other question about this patient. What were her fertility plans or issues, if any?
Yeah, that's a great question. She already had two children and we're not planning on having any more, luckily, because that certainly makes it more complicated.
Yeah. What are you doing nowadays for people, you know, particularly when she started out with metastatic disease in terms of if they, you know, I don't know if you ever see people who still want to have children despite of mets.
I do. I have one person going through egg retrieval right now.
Wow.
You know, I think it's a little more complicated in the curative setting. You know, that's a situation where almost everyone wants to see fertility, egg bank. You know, now with the data from the positive trial, you know, suggesting that it even could be safe to do 2 years of endocrine therapy, have a trial of coming off, trying to get pregnant, and then go back on. In the metastatic setting, it's a little bit trickier because, you know, it's probably not safe for them to carry their own child. Now, they still could retrieve eggs and use a gestational surrogate. But most of the time, those patients choose to have their families through other ways, such as adoption or, you know, getting an embryo and a surrogate or something like that. But it's certainly a conversation to have with each person.
All right, let's hear about your 72-year-old lady.
Yeah, this is a really sweet lady. She's retired. She used to be a teacher. She's 72. She takes care of her grandson full-time on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and he goes to preschool on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And that was very important to her. So she was willing to do whatever for treatment as long as it didn't interfere with Tuesdays and Thursdays and her grandson's time. So she had a history of breast cancer dating back to 2014. No negative disease, actually. Intermediate low oncotype. She completed her 5 years of AI therapy. She did everything right. She got adjuvant radiation after her lumpectomy. And lo and behold, really about 6 years later, after she'd already been off of her AI for over a year, she was presented with bone pain and she was found to have metastatic breast cancer. Still ERPR positive, HER2 non-amplified. She, at that time, started AI and palbociclib. She required two dose reductions for neutropenia. She remained on treatment for 23 months, so pretty good. She ended up enrolling on a clinical trial with a Circa, H3B6545. She did well on that for 8 months. And so, you know, this is a situation we encounter in clinic a lot. You know, how far do you go with the endocrine agents? And my rule of thumb is if they're getting more than 6 months benefit out of each endocrine therapy I give them, I'm going to keep going with endocrine therapy until their disease tells me otherwise. So we also put her on clinical trial with ARV 471, and she remains on study at 11 months, and she has a little bit of fatigue. Grade one fatigue really is her only side effect.
Can you remind me what a Circa is?
So Circa is a selective estrogen receptor covalent antagonist, okay? So this is really a blocker, but it's not a degrader. So it antagonizes the estrogen receptor, but doesn't degrade it. There's also CERANs. We like to call this the word salad. That's a complete estrogen receptor antagonist. So instead of antagonizing just the AF1 domain, which is typical for estrogen antagonists, it antagonizes both AF1 and AF2. So kind of we think of AF2 as a mechanism of resistance.
So this isn't going to turn into sort of a myeloma 5-drug thing in the future, is it?
I hope not. You know, I think it's probably fair to say that we are going to see endocrine backbones with a targeted agent. That's pretty much, you know, our MO these days. And I don't see it probably being much different with these drugs unless we have a blockbuster drug just that doesn't need that second agent. But I don't think we're going to see us combining these agents altogether, probably.
Any new agents that you're excited about, even outside of breast cancer? I'm not sure exactly what you get exposed to. Your CV is unbelievable. I've never seen somebody with so many trials under your name. It's incredible. But any new anything we haven't talked about today that you're excited about?
Yeah, I'll give you maybe a breast cancer bite and another ADC that I'm excited about, an ovarian bite. And so awesome. In breast cancer, companies are starting to look at CDKs beyond CDK4/6s. So CDK2 actually has a lot of compelling preclinical data. It's farther behind, but that's a compound to watch. And then antibody drug conjugates aren't just for breast anymore. They're quickly going out to a lot of different tumor types. We've seen bladder data. We've had mirvetuximab, for example. We have trastuzumab deruxtecan, a tumor agnostic indication. But another drug that's coming is a CDH6 antibody drug conjugate. It's looking at ovarian. I had the opportunity to present some data a couple of years ago, but showing a really impressive response rate in ovarian. And that's a disease where, unfortunately, you know, a lot of drugs just don't work incredibly well. So I've been excited about that as well.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Hamilton, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.